Thank you very much. The clerk will call the next case.
Fulton et al. Versus McKinney. Grant B. Penrod, Del A. Davenport, Appellant's Counsel. Charles J. McCall, Appellee's Counsel.
Mr. Penrod, are you prepared to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
All right, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Grant Penrod. I'm with the Hoover Penrod Law Firm in Harrisonburg, and I represent the appellants in this case, William and Scheller Bolton. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please.
All right.
This is a case about the appellee, John McKinney's abuse of the legal system to harass the Boltons with litigation. After Mr. McKinney entered into a binding contract not to file lawsuits against the Boltons, and after Mr. McKinney was paid $25,000 not to file lawsuits against the Boltons, Mr. McKinney breached that contract multiple times by filing lawsuits against the Boltons. As each of those suits was dismissed as meritless by the court that reviewed it, he then in turn filed another lawsuit in another court. The ruling in this case by the circuit court that McKinney breached the contract is final and has not been appealed. This appeal concerns the damages that are available at common law for McKinney's breach of his contract not to file lawsuits. And this case, I must acknowledge, presents a potential conflict between two well-established legal principles. On the one hand, we have the damages that are available to litigants in any type of case for a breach of contract. And on the other hand, we have what we sometimes call the American rule, which is that parties bear their own attorney's fees in litigation. I'd submit to the court that if there is a conflict between these two principles, that conflict should weigh in favor of contract damages. The damages available at contract is the older law, the old Saw case from law school, Hadley versus Baxendale, the millwheel case, was from 1854, was the English Court of Exchequer, and that court at that time said that those rules were well established. In contrast, the American rule, as it's been interpreted by this court, has always been called a general rule, not an absolute rule. And there are many, many exceptions to that general rule that this court has recognized in cases like Prospect Development Company versus Burschader, Burris versus Hines, Hiss versus Friedberg, and Long versus Abruzzetti. What the Boltons are asking for in this case is the benefit of their bargain. As this court ruled in the Southeast Lumber Company versus Friend case, McKinney cannot take the benefits of his contract, the $25,000, and avoid the obligations of his contract, not to file lawsuits. Mr. McKinney can't use his own breaches to benefit himself and shouldn't be able to create a lose-lose situation for the Boltons where he has given them, sold them a right to which they have no remedy. Now, the Boltons' damages, as we've briefed, are available at common law for two different reasons. One, because they are, in this particular case where we have a contract not to file lawsuits, they are the direct damages of the breaches by filing lawsuits. The attorney's fees are the very damages that this contract was intended to prevent. And if these damages are not available to the Boltons, then no damages are available, and the contract is meaningless and practically unenforceable. As this court held in the Prospect Development Company versus Burschader case in 1999, in circumstances like that, the plaintiff's victory becomes hollow. He's proved that he's been injured, but because he has to pay, in the Burschader case, more than $100,000 in attorney's fees to achieve his victory, the victory's hollow. And the court in that case awarded fees for fraud, even though we had a general rule that fees weren't awarded at that time. But in addition to direct damages, in this particular case, under these particular facts, the Boltons' damages are consequential damages which were recoverable at common law because they were contemplated by the parties at the time they entered into the contract. In fact, the law, as announced in Long versus Abruzzetti, is that the circumstances that were actually foreseen and that could reasonably be foreseen by the parties are consequential damages that could be recovered. And of course, reasonable people know that if you file a lawsuit, especially a lawsuit asking for a lot of money, the defendant is going to have to reply or be in default, and the defendant is going to have to hire an attorney. Reasonable people know that when they breach an agreement not to file lawsuits, that the other side is going to incur fees. But this case, the facts of this case go further because the parties were both represented by counsel when they entered into the agreement. They had incurred attorney's fees in prior litigation with each other at the time the agreement was entered. And at the trial in this case, Mr. McKinney testified that he knew the Boltons would incur attorney's fees when he filed his meritless lawsuits against them. And so these were fees, these were damages that were actually contemplated and are therefore recoverable at the common law.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. May I ask you this?
Yes.
Why aren't your damages direct damages? You have a covenant not to sue.
I think they are direct damages. I'm sorry,
well,
Judge.
Hadley is a limiting principle to consequential damages. It is not a limiting principle to direct damages.
Judge, I believe they are direct damages in this case, and that would be our primary argument. That, you know, in a normal breach of contract case, if you've got a contract to say deliver a mill wheel, and the mill wheel's not delivered, your damages that you claim might be your lost profits or the loss of the mill wheel, the attorney's fees that you incur to recover those damages are consequential. They are a step removed from the direct damage of the contract. Here we have a contract not to file lawsuits. And so the attorney's fees, I believe, are the direct damage. They are the harm that happens when lawsuits are filed when you've agreed not to file lawsuits. And so our argument that there are consequential damages is in addition to our argument that they are direct damages. They're both direct and consequential.
Let me ask you this question, if I might. Why is your claim for attorney's fees, which is an issue provided by contract, why isn't that something that needs to be presented in each one of the cases that you now aggregate for one big claim for what you call consequential damages? In this case, you have a contract. It has a damages clause, which is interestingly enough hooked to arbitration, but that's another matter altogether. Why isn't it incumbent upon you to raise the issues that you raise now in the aggregate? Why isn't it something you need to raise specifically in each one of the cases before those cases get dismissed?
For a couple different reasons, Judge. One, counterclaims generally are not compulsory in Virginia. Your counterclaim can be brought as a separate suit. Most of these suits were thrown out on demurrer. In fact, the one in the Western District of Virginia was thrown out for jurisdictional reasons. And so my client incurred attorney's fees defending a meritless lawsuit in the Western District of Virginia, which is a breach of the contract. But that court would not have had jurisdiction to hear a counterclaim because the court didn't have jurisdiction to hear the underlying claim. So it couldn't have been brought there. So I think there's a practical issue as well. And the practical issue is some of these cases were, again, dismissed quickly on demurrer, and my client's hope was that that would be the end of it after the first breach was dismissed. But then there was another breach and another breach and another breach. And so my client, in order to stop this, had to file this lawsuit and is, again, entitled to his damages for the breach, I believe. My primary answer, though, Judge, is that I don't think the counterclaim is compulsory. I think that this can be addressed. The cases do go into that, and again, the cases talk about there's a general rule. I believe this is in Long versus Abruzzetti, which is following Hiss versus Freeburg. And what the court in Long said was that fees between the same parties in present and previous litigation generally are not recoverable. Didn't say absolutely not recoverable, said generally are not recoverable. And then the Long case goes on to give a rather extensive discussion about direct damages and consequential damages. And that's the emphasis in the Long case, is are these attorney's fees a direct damage of the breach? In that case, they weren't, because the contract was about serving as an escrow agent. It wasn't a contract not to file lawsuits. And so then the court went on to talk about were they contemplated consequential damages, and ultimately the court said there was no evidence that the damages were contemplated, and that's why they were denied, not because they were from previous litigation and not because they were between the same parties. Again, the focus being on, are these damages that are available under contract principles?
Well, as I read the agreement, and I will confess that it's difficult, but I didn't write the agreement. The parties entered into the agreement. The subject of contractual damages comes up in one paragraph, and it says you get the damages if the matter is arbitrated and if you prevail. That didn't happen in any of those cases.
Judge, I've got to be careful because this is a subject that was appeal was requested on but not granted on in this case. Arbitration, the circuit court's early ruling in this case was that Mr. McKinney had waived the arbitration clause. And so our understanding was arbitration has been waived, we're now in court. And then we got this catch-22 ruling from the circuit court that arbitration is waived, but the damages can only be awarded in arbitration. And my clients end up in this catch-22. But aside from that, most contracts don't list all of your remedies if there's a breach. That's why we have a common law that says these are the damages that are available. And our argument is these damages are available at common law. They don't have to be specified in the contract because they're available at common law.
Well, then what use is an arbitration paragraph that says the parties must arbitrate and you get attorney's fees if you prevail in arbitration? So what use is that contract or that paragraph?
It would have been of use if Mr. McKinney had followed it, but he filed lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit, and the circuit court ruled that he had waived it because he had breached it. I mean, the rule in the Commonwealth is you can't, the party who has breached the agreement cannot rely on the agreement that they have breached. We had an extensive letter opinion from the judge about that issue, and I think that's why we ended up in court and not in arbitration because of McKinney's waiver.
All right.
I see that I've got
counsel. This is Justice Kelsey.
Yes, Judge.
Following up with your last comment, are there any provisions in this agreement? Remind me if there are, that say that the specified remedies are the exclusive remedies under the agreement.
I don't know. I would have to read the contract, and it is more pages than I would be able to read right now. I can try to do that while opposing counsel is arguing and see if I can find something.
Well, it wouldn't matter if it's the argument.
Go ahead.
It wouldn't matter if the argument's never been raised by the appellee in the case, but I'm just asking if you know of any.
I don't know of any.
Okay.
You have two minutes and 2 seconds left. Do you want to reserve it?
Yes, please.
All right, Mr. McCall.
Good morning to the court. For the record, my name is Charles J. McCall. I represent the appellee in this case, John W. McKinney. The appellants focus on the common law remedy for the award of attorney's fees. We don't take issue with that or quarrel with it. But we do take issue that the appellants advance the argument. Why? Because we believe that the appellant's presentation at the issue before the court, that the circuit court erred in not awarding attorney's fees based on a common law theory, is in itself in error. Why? The appellant does not take issue with the fact that there is a settlement agreement contained in an arbitration clause, that the arbitration agreement's enforceable and in favor, and they're favored in the Commonwealth of Virginia, or the issue before the court is arbitrable.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. If I may interrupt you with a question.
Yes.
Didn't the trial court hold that your client waived the arbitration clause, and didn't we not grant that assignment of cross error?
The court did. I wasn't aware that it granted a cross error, Your Honor.
No, is the issue of whether or not the arbitration clause was properly waived, whether the trial court held it was properly waived, is that before the court? Okay, so if the trial court held it wasn't, it's not before that court because it was waived, how can it be before us now?
Well, it's not before the court, Your Honor. Perhaps that was an error in my part, but we did not file a cross error on that.
Go ahead.
If I may continue. The appellate, okay, nevertheless, under the standards of review in this appeal, this court's going to review the settlement agreement de novo, and it'll also review de novo the trial judge's application of the law to the facts as determined by that court. Accordingly, this court will apply, among other things, the same analytical criteria utilized by the trial judge, Judge Petros, as outlined in his letter of opinion of February the 13th, 2019, in analyzing the language of the settlement agreement and its application of the law to the conclusions he drew after reviewing the language. In the settlement agreement, as stated in Judge Petros' letter opinion, quote, in the clause directly preceding the attorney's fees clause, Bolton and McKinney expressly agreed to resolve any disputes surrounding the agreement via arbitration. That the fees clause should then permit, in circumstances other than arbitration, where a party breaches that clause and proceeds to litigation, is inconsistent with their covenant not to sue. Bolton sued instead of proceeding to litigation, an act inconsistent with the agreement. Under the contract as written, attorney's fees are not permitted via litigation, and that's in the appendix at 73 and 74, close quote. Specifically with reference to attorney's fees, the settlement agreement provides that in the event of a dispute under this agreement that is resolved by binding arbitration, the prevailing party shall be entitled to receive a judgment and to collect from the non-prevailing party reasonable attorney's fees and costs incurred in prosecuting or defending against such claim. The appellate's argument is predicated on an unstated premise that it wishes this court to accept. That unstated premise is that the language in the settlement agreement addressing award of attorney's fees allows for an exception for common law attorney's fees to be awarded by the trial court, failure of which the appellant urges this court to accept as an error by the trial court and reverse that ruling. The appellant chose to overlook the fact that, as stated by Judge Petros, close quote, that is, as a whole, the agreement is unambiguous, close quote. The settlement agreement speaks of attorney's fees in a generic sense. It does not distinguish between statutory attorney's fees, contractually agreed upon attorney's fees, or...
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey again. May I interrupt with another question? So
yes, sir.
There's an arbitration clause, and there's a prevailing party attorney's fee provision in the arbitration clause. So what? That doesn't make it the exclusive remedy. It doesn't mean that it excludes all other attorney's fee claims that could otherwise be brought, particularly when the arbitration itself is being waived by the party asserting the argument. So in the absence of an exclusion of remedies clause, why does your point or Judge Petrus's point prevail?
Well, the reason is this, Your Honor. As the court is well aware, if parties are silent about attorney's fees, that may be up for argument in toto. If a contractual agreement references attorney's fees in some sense, for example, in this case, statutory fees, but neglects to mention contractually agreed fees or common law fees, it's presumed that they would have considered all of these issues on attorney's fees, and it was not included. In other words, they had their shot at putting in what they wanted to be considered. This, as Mr. Penrod stated, both parties were represented by attorneys. They had the opportunity, if they wanted to carve out an exception, but they did not. It simply
says...
Can
I interrupt again? When you keep saying carve out an exception, the premise behind that argument is that the common law does not award it. But we have a dozen cases that say if you breach a contract and cause third-party litigation, which is reasonably foreseeable under Hadley, that's a common law remedy available. You don't have to contractually say you have it. You have it because of common law. All the more, I would argue, it seems to me that the argument of your opponent is that his case is even better than that. Because the breacher himself is breaching the, is causing the out-of-pocket costs. This is not a transactional attorney's fee claim. This is a breach damage claim. So the argument circular is what I'm trying to get you to address. That's the argument that the appellant's making, is that your argument is circular. That the failure to have a clause that says he has fees means he doesn't get it. His whole argument is, I don't need a clause. And then your next point is, well, you should have put one in there because you put one in there for arbitration. The answer to that is, no, I don't have an exclusion of remedies clause, and I can say whatever I want to. An arbitration clause has nothing to do with my common law remedies. So how do you close the loop on that debate?
Well, I certainly attempt, Your Honor, but it seems to me that with respect to the arbitration clause, again, I realize it's circular and they had the opportunity to address other things, but a fundamental consideration for an arbitration agreement is that parties can contractually waive rights that they are entitled to go into court and pursue. I believe the arbitration cases in Virginia clearly recognize they can waive rights, and I think that.
But if your argument were right, they waive the right to sue you. It's not that they waive the right to attorney's fees. An arbitration clause, if it's enforceable, if the parties demand that it be implemented, means you can't sue people outside of arbitration. All the more you can't get damages once you sue them. So the logic of that point collapses on itself, because if that's the way we interpret your client's failure to invoke the arbitration clause and to outright waive it, then that means that they can't sue you at all for anything, attorney's fees or not, because the entire claim under that logic would be stuck in an arbitration that never happened because your client didn't want to go to arbitration. Does that make sense?
Well, I'm not saying that it's a matter of my client wanting to go to arbitration. I did not represent him in most of the litigation that was filed, so I was not a party to that. But it seems to me that if you accept the position that they can have a common law right to recover attorney's fees, irrespective of the language in the arbitration agreement, then that renders meaningless having an arbitration agreement in the first place, because it can't really be enforceable in a strict sense to go to arbitration if there's an exception. I mean, it makes it meaningless, and people who rely on an arbitration agreement could not rely on it.
No, it can be enforceable. All you had to do is say, I'm electing arbitration. And they would not be able to sue you and not waive it. They would not be able to sue you or seek damages from you or do anything to you. They'd all have to go to you. All of you'd have to go to arbitration. It's not a meaningless clause.
Well, I would like to bring to the court's attention that, and I don't have it before me, but I made the point with Judge Petros that notwithstanding the fact that the court had ruled that Mr. McKinney had waived arbitration, Mr. Bolton had not waived arbitration. That remedy was still available to him. And Judge Petros found that the decision by Mr. Bolton to proceed with litigation was inconsistent with the agreement.
But how can that be? Because the right to go to arbitration is a right. It is not a duty. If we have a contract and we both have a right to go to arbitration and you choose not to, I don't have a duty to force you. I don't have a duty to go to arbitration on my own. It's simply a right, and it's a right that they can waive. They're not waiving their – there's no duty to go to arbitration unless the other side demands it. And if the other side demands it, you have to go because that's what the contract says.
Well, that remedy was still available to Mr. Bolton. And I can only state again that the lower court found that Mr. Bolton his position to sue was inconsistent with the agreement. In effect, by implication, he said that Mr. Bolton's suing was in itself a breach of the agreement.
So you're saying that they should go to arbitration despite the fact that your client waived your right to go to arbitration?
Well, I think that they, as far as whether they should or not, that is an open question. Although I believe it that Mr. Bolton filing against my client was a breach of the agreement itself, and that he was compelled to go to arbitration. And I would also point out that in their petition for appeal, I believe that Mr. Penrod expressed that they had no objection to the court, this court ruling, and in favor of going to arbitration and sending the case to arbitration. They don't object to that, and neither do we. But they had the right to go to arbitration. Still, my client no longer has that right under the current ruling.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, one of the things that I was going to go into, but I don't know if it's relevant to much now, but I'm going to anyway with the court's indulgence. Judge Petros had a conversation with Mr. Penrod from the bench, and I quote the court, "How can the court reform the contract? Isn't that what you're asking me to do, Mr. Penrod?" "I'm not asking you to do that. I think the court's already ruled that the provision of the contract was waived pursuant to the law of arbitration." The court, "So it's waived, so it goes away, so arbitration no longer available, applies?" Mr. Penrod, "Yes, Judge." The court, "Now we have to write something in the contract that says if arbitration is waived and it goes to litigation before the court, Mr. Bolton can recover attorney's fees if he prevails. That's what you're asking me to write in here, Mr. Penrod." "I'm not asking you to write that in there. I'm asking you to disregard the part of the sentence which says, quote, resolved by binding arbitration, close quote, because Mr. McKinney has waived the arbitration provision." The court, "That's not rewriting the contract?" Mr. Penrod, "I don't think it's rewriting the contract. I think it's the law of the case that he's waived arbitration and he's permitting the court, therefore, to rule." Now, that appears at pages 128 and 29 of the transcript of the proceedings of January 22, 2019. In our view, Mr. Penrod's simply trying to get another bite at the apple to urge the court to rewrite the settlement agreement and say something it does not. What it does not say, what it does not do, is carve out an exception for the award of a common law attorney fees to be awarded by the trial court. The ultimate proof in the failure of the appellant's position is they've offered no argument or no authority for their interpretation of the attorney fee that would allow for an exception or reserved authority for common law attorney fees to be awarded by the court and only other attorney fees be awarded by the arbitrator. In effect, they've asked the court to disregard the very language that defeats their argument. Finally, I wish to address the question of whether the trial court has jurisdiction to proceed, whether had jurisdiction to proceed with the case rather than referring to arbitration. This court will always review jurisdiction. Since it's reviewing the contract de novo, it will review the question of jurisdiction as a trial court would. We've always maintained that the court lacked jurisdiction to hear the case once it went through the examination of the settlement agreement.
Under Counsel, the circumstances, may I interrupt again?
Yes.
So your position is that the trial court erred by not enforcing an arbitration clause that you waived. Is that what you're saying?
No, sir. No. Once the court ruled that Mr. McKinney had waived the arbitration clause, we didn't have any rights to do anything at all in that regard.
Well, then how can you be arguing that you have a right on appeal to demand that it be sent to arbitration?
We're requesting they go to arbitration. We're not demanding. That last part that I addressed was that since the Supreme Court addresses the review of the contract de novo, that it's in the same position as the trial court to first determine is there jurisdiction for the trial court to proceed on the merits in the case. And our position was that the trial court could review the document to ascertain if it had an arbitration clause, which it explicitly did, and whether or not it was enforceable, and specifically whether the issue before the parties was an arbitrable issue under the terms of the arbitration clause. For example, a manufacturer might have an agreement that they're going to supply a certain number of widgets to a company, and there arises a dispute in that regard, and they have an arbitration clause that covers that. However, they later have a dispute regarding the cost of the widgets and so forth and so on, and a court may determine.
Your time has expired.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Penrod, you have rebuttal time.
Thank you, Judge. Judge, I'd like to have a question
I'd like to ask you about this.
Yes.
The agreement says the arbitration shall be a breach shall be resolved by binding arbitration. And what you're saying, and I think I understand it, is that if neither side seeks to enforce that, then that particular paragraph is null and void for all sense and purposes. Both sides have waived the right to seek arbitration. Is that right?
I think a little more nuanced than that, but that's essentially right. I mean, again, what happened here is the parties entered into a contract which had an arbitration clause that said any future disputes would be resolved in arbitration. Mr. McKinney, the appellee, didn't follow that. He filed lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit, and he issued discovery in those lawsuits.
What do you do with the fact that either side could have demanded arbitration?
Well, that was the issue that was litigated early in this case, and what the circuit court ruled was that arbitration had been waived by McKinney because of his litigation, and if the Boltons were compelled to go to arbitration at this point, they would be at a disadvantage because of all of the discovery advantages that Mr. McKinney had gained in his prior litigation. Most of that discovery was done in a case that Mr. Bolton had already been dismissed from, but was done as a pretense to farm documents to use for his subsequent lawsuits. And we had a hearing on that. We had evidence on that. And that's why Judge Ritchie ruled early in the case that this case should not go to arbitration. Mr. McKinney had abused litigation and arbitration had been waived. And so I think that leads us to one of two places.
Counsel, this is Justice Goodwin. You say that the judge ruled that the matter shouldn't go to arbitration. It's because you didn't want it to go to arbitration.
Because my client would have been disadvantaged had it gone to arbitration because of all of the discovery that had been initiated by Mr. McKinney. My client would have been going into arbitration with one hand tied behind his back.
Okay, but
and
the
that's
reason
what
why
the court,
not,
the court agreed, with, agreed with us, and that's what the trial court ruled.
Right, but I'm just saying you could have sought arbitration if you desired to have it.
We could have, but again, it would have been a process that we would have been disadvantaged in. It wouldn't have been a fair playing field because of McKinney's prior use of litigation. It put my client in this catch-22 position. Do we go into arbitration where we're disadvantaged, or do we go to court? And we asked the judge to make a decision, which path shall we take? The judge said we can stay in court. And then we get to the end of the case, and a different judge, because of the substitution rules, well, you should have stayed in arbitration because that's where your damages were available. And that's the catch-22. Either go to a forum.
Let me ask you a question about your catch-22. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the claim that you have is that their lawsuits were non-meritorious that were dismissed, what kind of discovery from them do you need concerning that?
The cases, all of them, had been fought by Mr. McKinney very adamantly. And we anticipated that he was not going to admit that he had filed those lawsuits, that we were going to have to do interrogatories and requests for admissions as to the fact that the documents were his. And much to our surprise, once we got past the motion to arbitration and they had to respond to our complaint, they admitted to so many things, we were able to get summary judgment on those issues. But we didn't know that at the time we opposed arbitration. We were anticipating.
You didn't know that he had sued you?
No, we didn't know that he was going to admit to those things. We thought we were going to have to engage in discovery to prove them. These things aren't in the appendix to the case, but the record to this case includes pleading after pleading
that's,
after pleading.
That's okay, counsel. You've answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
All right, counsel, you're over your time as well. So thank you all for your argument.
Thank you, Annie.